We'll call the meeting to order. This is the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee. Good morning, everyone. My name is Denny McNamara. I'm a state representative from down in Hastings. I served, this is my fifth term. We're excited to all be here. I think we'll go around the room. Why don't we start on my left with Representative Hansen, and then we'll introduce ourselves. And once we get introduced, I'll just lay out a couple ground rules.
Well, good morning. I'm Representative Rick Hansen. I represent an area a little north of the chair. I'm in northern Dakota County. I represent part of South St. Paul, West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, Lilydale, and a little bit of Egan.
Good morning. I'm Representative John Purcell. I represent North Central Minnesota, Bemidji, Leech Lake Indian Reservation, District 4A.
Jean Wagenius, South Minneapolis, between roughly 35W and the Hiawatha line.
I'm Bill Hilty. I represent District 8A, which is about half of Pine, most of Carlton, and a little bit of St. Louis counties.
Bob Eliff with House Research.
Janelle Taylor with House Research.
Jim Reynolds with House Fiscal Analysis Department.
Mike Harris, Denny McNamara's CLA.
Hi, I'm Amy Rudolph. I'll be the committee administrator.
Paul Torkelson. I represent District 21B, all of Brown, part of Watonwan, and part of Redwood County, and I'm the vice chair of the committee.
Dwayne Quam. I represent all of Dodge and part of Olmsted County, 29A.
Good morning. Hi, I'm Paul Anderson. I represent 13A, which is all of Pope County, parts of Stearns and Candiohi counties.
Good morning, I'm Dan Fabian. I represent District 1A, which is all of Roseau County, Kitson County, the eastern half of Marshall County, Pennington County, and a small part of southern Manitoba. No, I'm just kidding.
Dave Hancock, I represent District 2B. I used to think it was northern Minnesota until Dan tells me it's central Minnesota, but it runs from Park Rapids north, basically some of Hubbard County, a little bit of Pennington and Polk. Most of Clearwater and a good portion of Beltrami.
Hey, Draz, before you go, I don't want to be embarrassed. These are really good donuts from Emily, so I don't want to be the only one that has to eat two or three. So if everybody would be glad to take one. It was my treat today from Emily's Bakery in Hastings, and it's a really good deal. And for the people in the audience, there is coffee there. And I will tell everybody, this is the state of Minnesota's dining room table that we're eating and drinking on. So that I got the word from about 14 different staff that if we screw this up, the coffee's turned off. So we'll try and always keep it on a napkin, or I'm supposed to get coasters, and I didn't get that done by today. But if we can respect that and be, and the folks in the audience are welcome to share in it too. So go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you, Representative Draskowski.
No problem, Denny. Thank you. You got me in on the donuts. I'm doing good. Thank you. Steve Draskowski, 28B, which represents actually a significant portion of the banana belt of Minnesota, which is southeastern Minnesota, southern Wabasha and Goodhue counties, northern Winona County, and that's where the cocoa for the donuts is grown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, we complain about the freshman 15 that we all put on when we're here. This is why. Thank you for helping keep the tradition alive. I'm Mike Beard. I represent Shakopee and Prior Lake on southwest metro area here in the Twin Cities.
Representative Tom Hackbarth. I represent District 48A, part of Sherburne County, City of Elk River, and northern Anoka County.
Okay, well, thank you all for being here. Oh, did we get, we didn't get the staff yet, did we? I'm sorry,
no, go ahead. I'm Christina Pearson.
If you could talk into the microphone.
Hi, I'm Christina Pearson. I'm with the House Republican Research.
Eileen Shore, DFL House Research.
Well, thank you all for being here. And then the other reminder I would say, if your cell phone goes off, it needs to be on vibrate. I'd really appreciate it if it wasn't one of those that sat on the table and the whole audience saw it shake and could hear it. That'd be great. If it does go off, if you get up and leave the room and answer it when you get past the first door, that would be great. For the audience, you don't want to be embarrassed, so put yours on silence also. And that'll work for the best. I think we'll have a good time here. We're going to run fairly fast-paced. As you know, it's a combination of a number of committees. With us today is Professor Deb Schwackhammer. And she's going to do a report on a study that we asked her to fund last year with Clean Water Legacy money. And we have two introductions to do. We have Ron and Ben, who are our pages, who are both experienced. Ron's the one with the donuts, and Ben's the one that's paying attention to what's going on. So let's give them and all the staff a hand, because they're going to be working real hard. Professor Swackhammer, if you could introduce yourself for the tape, and then go ahead. It's our thoughts that she's going to go through her presentation. It's going to be fairly lengthy. We're going to save our questions for the end, because hopefully a lot of her questions will get answered. After she does her presentation, we're going to have time for some questions, and then we're going to hear from the EQB on a similar water report that was also due in for us. Professor Swackhammer's report is going to take about an hour, and the second one will take about a half hour total. So if you could go through that. I would concentrate, if I'm not mistaken, from the article in the Star Tribune this morning. You're going to make three recommendations. We'd like to hear those. That's the most important thing. And then we'd also like to hear what are the facts that you based your recommendations on. And we're going to do one introduction before you get going, Professor. Representative, you want to introduce yourself?
I apologize, Mr. Chair, for being late. Representative Peggy Scott.
Okay, and we have one more. Representative Knuth, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kate Knuth.
And your district?
New Brighton, Arden Hills, Fridley, and Shoreview.
Andrew.
Andrew.
Oh, Representative Falk.
Morning. I'm Representative Andrew Falk, District 20A, so the entireties of Swift, Lacaparo, Big Stone, Lincoln, and the western half of Medicine County.
Professor.
Good morning. My name is Deborah Swackhammer, and I'm a professor of public health and public affairs at the University of Minnesota, and I also am co-director of the university's Water Resources Center. And I'm here to present to you the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework. We at the university were asked to construct and design a sustainability framework around water, funded through the Clean Water Fund, and the reason we were asked was to basically to develop a framework that was focused on sustainability and was an independent assessment of to provide advice to the legislature on where investments might be made in order to reach water sustainability. I want to point out that this framework is, in fact, not limited by the Clean Water Fund, but is we hope that it will provide guidance for investments made by the Clean Water Fund as well as other investments by the state. So this framework is a 25-year plan to protect, conserve, and enhance the quality and quantity of the state's groundwater and surface water. There are three fundamental principles around this framework. The first is that it is all to do with water sustainability, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. It's comprehensive. It's the only plan in the country that approaches this degree of comprehensiveness. We are addressing groundwater and surface water together. We are addressing quantity and quality together. And we are addressing human health and ecological health together. And there is no other state in the union that has come close to really addressing water in such a holistic manner. Sustainable water use was defined by the legislature, actually was defined by the DNR and EQB prior to that, but then was put into session law 2 years ago, as sustainable water use does not harm ecosystems, degrade water quality, or compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And so that is the definition from which we are working. There are two key concepts within this definition. The first is that we're talking about ecosystems and human health. The word ecosystems is in that language. And the other is that we're talking about making sure that we have enough water and enough clean water for future generations. So it has to do with the long term. Sustainability has three pillars that make sustainability work, and you must have all three to truly have sustainability. And that includes not just environmental issues and addressing environmental issues, but it includes aspects of our social and economic sectors as well. The mandate within the request from the legislature asked us to address drinking water, storm water, agricultural use of water, industrial use of water, and surface and groundwater interactions. Also, infrastructure needs for the state, and all in the context of climate change, land use, development, and changing demographics. In addition, we've identified the best management practices around wastewater treatment, drinking water source protection, pollution prevention, conservation, and water valuation. We were asked to be collaborative, but coming from the university, I can assure you that's what we're quite good at. We're very good at bringing groups of people together around an issue, bringing experts together. So the University of Minnesota worked with all of the relevant state agencies that are listed here. All of them participated in developing this framework. We also worked with watershed districts, watershed management organizations, soil and water conservation districts, non-government organizations, counties and cities, and citizens. The approach that we took was fairly complicated, and I beg the chair's forgiveness. I'm going to spend just a few minutes on the process that we took because I think it's very critical to understand that in order to appreciate the full context of this framework. The Water Resources Center at the university first created a Headwaters Council. This is an external advisory committee. This kind of kept us on the straight and narrow, made sure we were keeping to our task, and gave us external advice when requested. This consisted of about 25 people who are the thought leaders on water from around the state and region. Collectively, they had about 300 years of perspective on water and experience on water. So this was quite the illustrious group. We also created a citizen and stakeholder advisory group. And this was specifically so that we had a place for stakeholder and special interest discussions. We had a way to contact citizens and NGOs. We had a way to get their information to us. They were formed immediately. So we're not doing stakeholder involvement and public engagement at the end as an add-on. They have been involved since the get-go. So we have had lots of input and lots of involvement from stakeholders and from citizens from the very beginning. We needed to know everything we could possibly know about the water in Minnesota. We created 5 technical teams that were based, that contained experts on a specific discipline, and they were based around specific water use. So we had a team on domestic use of water, energy and industrial use of water, recreational, spiritual, and cultural use of water, agricultural use of water, and how the ecosystem uses water, ecosystem services. So these 5 teams were asked to prepare white papers. They met for a few months and they designed, they answered the question, what do we know about this kind of water use? What don't we know about this water use? And what are the issues that need to be addressed in order for this water use to be sustainable? In addition, we had 3 other teams. One team was a valuation team. They looked at how we value water. These were largely economists and looked at the economic models around water valuation. We had an education team that looked at how we educate people about water, both formally and informally, and how adequate or inadequate those systems are and delivery systems. And we had a team on policy that looked at past water policy, summarized that, and then assessed the current state of water policy for the state of Minnesota in the context of federal law. Finally, we had a synthesis team, and this group gets a lot of credit. They met weekly for about a day a week for about 15 weeks, and that was really pretty heavy lifting for volunteers. These were all water experts from different perspectives and different experiences, and they met and they advised on developing the issues, on developing the strategies, and developing the recommendations that I will present to you. I will tell you there was widespread agreement on those issues. I'd say it was consensus on the issues and on the strategies, and there's widespread agreement with the recommendations. But ultimately, this report is coming from the University of Minnesota based on our very best judgment from the science and information we gathered. We had a variety of different team members involved. We had more than 200 people, 200 water professionals involved in developing this framework. And I just wanted to give you some sense of the breadth and diversity of representation on these various work teams. We also prepared white papers from the university itself that were summarizing what we know about water use by Minnesotans, what we know about the water supply in Minnesota, how much water do we have, and what we know about water quality in the state. And these 3 papers really pulled together all of the available information and summarized it very nicely. I hope these will serve as excellent background papers for you in the future, and they're available on our website. We also heard presentations from the state climatologist, from the state demographer, and from the University of Minnesota on those 3 big drivers of land use, demographic change, and climate change. The white papers that were prepared by the eight teams that I just mentioned are all available for you at the Water Resources website. These are all up and available at any time. So if you have a specific interest in one of these particular topics, you can find it on our website. Now, let me get to the issues. We identified 10 big issues as a result of synthesizing those white papers and all the information that those teams brought to us. And those, those 10 issues are as follows. They are environmental issues. We have 6 major issues that relate directly to water and the environment. And they are sustainable water supply, the need for a sustainable water supply, the issue of excess nutrients and conventional pollutants, contaminants of emerging concern, the land-water connection, the need for ecological and hydrological integrity, and the water-energy nexus. And I will talk about each of these in turn. We also identified 2 economic issues that are necessary to address to achieve water sustainability, and they are water valuation and pricing and infrastructure needs. That would be public infrastructure such as drinking water treatment plants and wastewater treatment plants. And then 2 social issues dealing with citizen engagement and education and governance and institutions. Now, we have these 4 overarching drivers that really determine what happens to water in this state and actually throughout the nation. We have climate as a major driving variable. We have changing demographics as a driving variable. We have land use and how we use the land is a huge impact on what happens to water. And energy is also very much connected to water, and I'll talk more about that. But energy is a huge driver when it comes to water use and quality. These are all interconnected amongst themselves. These are not isolated drivers. They all interact amongst themselves. And the 10 issues that I just named for you are not independent. They are not 10 little chapters that you can kind of think of as separate boxes or anything like that. They are all interrelated. So if you take those 6 environmental issues, you will see that, in fact, they are all related to each other, and they're related to those drivers. So water is a very complex system. Excuse me. And so it's important to remember that we can't deal with any one of these issues without touching or inadvertently touching on another issue, and we must always be thinking about water as one system, very interconnected. This water system is then further influenced by social issues and by economic issues. Now, in the framework, and the framework is now available, a draft is available, it's about 200 pages. It's a pretty hefty document. And what I'd like to do is walk you through the major points of that document. For each of those 10 issues, we identify the problem. We describe for you what the problem is, so why is it an issue? And we also describe a desired Minnesota future. What is the future condition of Minnesota? If you look out 25 years, how do you want things to be different as a result of implementing this framework? We have a series of strategies and objectives. And this is the what. What do you do about the issue? And then we have recommended actions. And this is how do you implement the strategy? So this report gets pretty specific or pretty detailed. I think we tried to balance getting too specific when we can't really predict 25 years in the future, but we tried to make this as usable a framework as possible to give you as much guidance as possible around these issues. In addition, we have identified the benchmarks for measuring progress around each of these issues, and we provide an implementation schedule and an impact matrix. And I'll give you examples of these in just a minute. Let me talk about the first issue, and that is the need for a sustainable and clean water supply. So what is the problem here? Well, one problem is that the population in Minnesota, we know, is growing. And by 2030, it will have another 22% population. So we'll have increased the population another 1 million people. Given that, we also know that water use currently is growing faster than population. And so by that same time frame, by 2030, we'll be using probably 30% more water. So we have to come up with 30% more water just to stay even, much less have enough water to make sure that we're okay today. So we're talking about a significant increase in water demand over the next 25 years. Secondly, we know from studies done by the EQB and the DNR that we are potentially short of water in the metro area at the very least. So by 2030, the projection is that there are a significant number of counties in the metro area that are potentially at risk for using more water than they replace. So these studies are well documented and well known within the government, and they really just raise a red flag that we cannot continue to just assume we will always have enough water. So what is our desired future? It's to have enough water of sufficient quality that's protected for use for all future generations. That's the ultimate goal of water sustainability. So our first recommended strategy is to determine the state's water balance. What I mean by this, I liken this to a bank account. If you have a bank account, or if your spouse has a bank account, and they are spending money willy-nilly, but they have no idea how much there's being deposited, and they have no idea how much is actually in the bank, you would say they're not spending their money wisely. You would say they're not being fiscally responsible. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. Well, that's what we're doing with our water. We're treating our water with irresponsibly in the sense that we have no idea how much water we have in the bank. We don't know how much water we're depositing. We do know we're using water, and we're using it at an accelerating rate. And so we are basically, we simply don't know our water bank account, all right? So the water balance is understanding that bank account, that water bank account, over time. The reason it's over time is that water moves all the time. It's not static like money in a bank. It's not just sitting in a pond underneath the soil. It's moving all the time, and it moves at different rates between different aquifers. So we need to know the picture of the water balance over time. So it's like knowing your bank account over time, over a year's period or over a month's period. So in order to get there, what do we need to do? So the strategy is determine that water balance, determine that bank account picture. The recommendation is to accelerate the development of the county geologic atlases and the aquifer characterization mapping. Both of these are currently underway, but they're on a long time frame. They're not slated to be completed for another 25 years. We feel that in order to know the water balance, we're going to need to know this information faster. So our recommendation is to accelerate the completion of these atlases, the development of these atlases, and the development of the aquifer mapping. This is currently being done. This would require also a hydrologic monitoring network that would basically take existing monitoring capabilities but expand them considerably and develop a model that would take that monitoring information and be able to make sense of it so we'd have a model that could tell us how water moves within the state of Minnesota over time. We also are recommending that our current, so this would take a long time. It's going to take about 10 years to do that, even if you accelerate the mapping and the atlases. It'll take about 10 years for us to know our water balance really well. So that's a long-term investment, but the good news is that's what the whole point of the Clean Water Fund and the fact that we're doing a sustainability framework for you is that we are able to think long-term instead of thinking short-term. So this is a long-term recommendation. In the meantime, what can we do? We have a recommendation to improve our withdrawal permitting system. Currently, we have a permitting system that essentially, I'm kind of simplifying things, we issue all permits that are requested, and then we suspend them if there's a problem. And we also do this all by paper. And we're recommending that the permitting process that the DNR uses for water withdrawal be updated and be modernized and be streamlined so that applications are done online in a screening process. That data then is entered online. And then easy permits could be granted by that online screening. Subsequent permits that were more difficult could be evaluated, and we're recommending that they be evaluated for their impact on if you have groundwater withdrawal, you want to make sure that you don't impact surface water conditions. In Minnesota, we have a very complicated set of aquifers, and much of our groundwater feeds our surface water. I know this is a really odd thing if you haven't thought about it, but in Minnesota, if you withdraw too much groundwater, you'll actually lower surface water concentrations of nearby ponds and streams. And so we want to make sure that we protect our surface water and don't over-withdraw our groundwater. To do that, we need to understand the ecological needs of that surface water. We're recommending that that be determined. There are ways to do that. In fact, there's ongoing research both in this state and elsewhere that is looking at that exact issue of developing ecological-based thresholds for water withdrawal. So that's one of our major recommendations, is to update the permitting system and also to develop our water balance. So Secondly, we have a recommendation strategy to reduce the risk from private drinking water wells. About 25 to 30% of the state drinks private well water. I'm one of them. I live in Washington County, and I have a well. And we know that drinking water, because it's not regulated by the state, it's considered private. You own the water that is under your land, and so we don't have a mechanism to really regulate that water. But we can try to ensure public health and make sure that that drinking water is as safe as possible. So we're recommending that all private wells be mapped. Currently, there is no actual map. You can't point to all the private wells. We are recommending that they be tested at the time of house sale, at home sale, so that you would know the concentrations of contaminants at any point that well changed hands, that we would offer homeowner testing clinics, that we would offer educational opportunities and opportunities to test well water and make it more convenient and more obvious for how homeowners could be doing that, and to educate the homeowners on the effects. Why do we care about the water quality? Why should they care about the water quality of their private well? Now, this is an example of the implementation timeline. We've provided for each of our recommendations a sense of how long it will take to implement and when one would start that implementation. We're not recommending that everything start today. Much as I would like to see this entire framework adopted by this committee, I will say that we are recommending that parts of it get adopted now, parts of it adopted in a few years, parts of it adopted at 5 years, parts of it adopted in 10 years. And we're giving you that timeline and a tiered approach or phased approach to implementation so that it's a more manageable approach to things, so that we're providing you as much information as we possibly can on this issue. We also provide you with an impact matrix to help sort of sort both the cost of these things as well as the impact on improving water quality and quantity, so the impact on achieving water sustainability. Not every recommendation is equal in here. Some have more import than others. Some are more urgent than others. And so we're giving you that timeline to give you a sense of urgency, but we also, that doesn't correspond necessarily to the same level of import. So we're making sure that you also know which of these have the biggest impact, and also we'll give you some sense of the cost. So, for instance, the low, medium, and high cost ranges are 1 to 1 million is low. That would be total cost for a given recommendation. The medium range is between 1 and 10 million total cost for a recommendation over time, and high would be greater than 10 million. But again, most of those big ticket items are spread out over about 10 years, so the per year cost is a little more, sounds a little bit more reasonable. And here's an example of the impact matrix where we're saying that first recommendation, determine the water balance, it's going to cost some money. But it's going to cost money over time, so take that into account. But the impact is huge. It's probably would have the biggest impact on achieving water sustainability of all the recommendations we have. So that's an example. 1B is the permitting process. That would be a medium cost, but again, very high impact. So this can help you sort through some of these recommendations and help provide you a bit of a roadmap for interpreting this document. Let me move to the second issue, and then I'll move a lot faster after we get through. I just wanted to give you a flavor for what the document holds, what the framework holds in terms of its recommendations. The second issue that we address is excess nutrients and other conventional pollutants. So think of these as the pollutants that we know of and are regulated. These are the ones that you hear about. If you're familiar with the TMDL process and impaired waters, these are the pollutants that cause those TMDLs, or the impaired waters, I should say. So what we know in the state of Minnesota is that we know that it is estimated that 40% of the water in Minnesota does not meet clean water standards. And these are clean water standards set under the guise of the Clean Water Act. So this is federal law that we are in violation of. And in fact, every state in the nation is in violation of the Clean Water Act. But we have 40% of our waters that are estimated to be not in compliance with clean water standards. What's our desired future? To be the state, to be the land of unimpaired waters. And I also would say our desired future should be the first state to have no listings on that impaired water list. That would be an incredible accomplishment for the state of Minnesota. Now, these water impairments, by impairment what I mean is an impaired water is a water body that does not meet clean water standards as set by the state and the federal government. And what we know about our current impaired waters is that much of them are 25% are caused by eutrophication. Eutrophication is the scientific word meaning excess nutrients causing excess algal growth. It causes taste and odor problems. It causes aesthetic problems, green scum, picture duckweed on your pond. And it causes oxygen depletion and fish kills in extreme situations. We also have impairments due to a handful of other things, but there's really like five things that are the dominant reason we have impaired waters. So this set of recommendations is how do we deal with meeting clean water standards around this handful of pollutants. The first strategy is to develop guidance at the statewide level on nutrient enrichment management plans. So have consistent guidance at the state level that is implemented at the watershed level. Now, when I use the word watershed here today, I'm talking about the major watersheds. There are 81 of them in the state of Minnesota. All right? So we're talking about approximately 80 watersheds. So we're talking fairly local, about the same size as counties, given the 87 counties. So we're talking about having this implemented at the local level, but we want consistent guidance across the state. Right now, we manage nutrients and bacteria and other pollutants in an isolated way. We manage stormwater. We manage agriculture. We manage this, that, and the other. But a phosphorus molecule doesn't care where it came from. It doesn't care if it was fertilizer on a lawn or fertilizer on a farm or whether it came out of a wastewater treatment plant. It's phosphorus. And you have excess phosphorus, you have a problem. And so what we're suggesting is that we manage this in a holistic way. We don't just manage one sector at a time. We manage phosphorus. We don't manage we manage all the sources together in an integrated way. How would that actually get implemented? So the how part is here. So we have a number of recommendations for how to achieve this. First of all, when we have an impaired water, we do something called a total maximum daily load assessment to determine how much excess pollution is there and how much would you have to reduce the loadings of pollutants to meet water quality standards. That's required by federal law to do that. And we're in the process of doing that. The MPCA has the authority to do that. What we don't do is then require those reductions to take place. The EPA does not require it, and the state of Minnesota does not require it. We're not required to actually take those reductions. We just study the reduction that's needed. Well, we're recommending that we actually take the bold step and say these reductions are mandatory, that, in fact, every impaired water would have to prepare an implementation plan, which they have to do now, but those implementation plans would be required. They would have clear compliance timelines and consequences for failure to comply, and that the implementation would be mandatory. That would require you to get involved, of course, in changing the law, but we feel that this is one of the single most important things to do in order to achieve meeting our clean water standards under federal law. This would require accelerating, it would be helped if we were to accelerate the assessment process of our state's waters. Right now, we've assessed 20%, and so we're not slated to complete that assessment for another 8 years. We would like to accelerate that assessment so we know the state of the water in Minnesota within a 5 to 6 year time frame. So we're recommending that the assessment and the implementation plans be accelerated by about a factor of two. We also have some other recommendations to deal with other sources of these pollutants. And that would include stormwater issues, shoreland rules, strengthening shoreland rules, and improving our management of septic. So we have some specifics in the document, which I won't dwell on, that deal with some other sources of some of these pollutants. In addition, we have a recommendation that in order to actually accelerate these improvements and meet clean water standards, we are going to have to involve both the currently regulated sectors that cause these impairments as well as the unregulated sectors. And so provide equity. Bring everyone to the table to make sure that we meet these clean water standards. The biggest source of unregulated pollution in the state is agriculture. And so agriculture would need to be involved. Agriculture needs to be at the table at discussing how to meet clean water standards. Currently, Minnesota is well regarded for the fact that it uses voluntary measures to try to improve water quality. And Minnesota has been a leader in this area. We know that the farmers care about water quality and are doing the best that they can with voluntary measures. The bad news is, as good as they're doing, and they're doing some of the best jobs in the country in terms of adopting best management practices, the problem is we still have impaired waters. 40% of the state is still out of compliance with clean water standards. And so we need to take that next step and have agriculture be part of a more robust solution. We are recommending that we establish farmer-led, performance-based approach to meeting clean water standards. And what do I mean by this? So imagine a county that has 50% agriculture in it. We would say the agricultural landowners in that watershed, excuse me, not county, imagine a watershed with 50% of the land in agricultural production. We would say those that 50% of agricultural land, those landowners would be put into essentially a cooperative, which we would call an agricultural management area. Collectively, they would need to meet those load reductions that are determined by federal and state processes through the TMDL process. Collectively, we are not recommending farmers be treated as point sources. We are not recommended that farmers have to go get permits. We are recommending that farmers, if they do the right thing and work together, they can meet clean water standards by using their own methodologies and working amongst themselves. There would be consequences for not meeting those standards, but the initial intent here is to let them determine how to do it. So we know that farmers are really the best stewards of their land, and every farm is different, and every part of the state is different. So to mandate how to meet these standards does not seem very reasonable to the agricultural community. To have them figure it out on their own and have them be part of the solution is critical. It's imperative to understand that we are not recommending that we just pass some law next week and that suddenly they have to be in compliance. We appreciate the difficulty of implementing something like this, and it also requires the state to fully assess all of its waters. So this goes hand in hand with the first recommendation to make implementation plans mandatory, but it will take about 10 years to implement this. So there's quite a bit of time to determine how this will happen, how it will unfold, and to make those adjustments. We're not recommending this be something that happened tomorrow. We are recommending that this is something that happen thoughtfully and carefully, and that we do it right, and that we get to the point where we have everyone at the table and we have them there in about a 10-year period. So the timelines, as you can see, are quite long. Again, this is a long-term investment in changing how we manage the state for achieving clean water standards, all right? And I just want to really emphasize that these clean water standards, we're not just trying to improve the water quality. We are out of compliance with federal law, and we need to come into compliance in the future. The impact of those two recommendations is extremely high. The first one is expensive, and the second one is much less expensive. But they're both very, very high impact. All right, let me move to the third issue, and then I'll really start to accelerate and give you just some of the highlights of the remaining seven issues. So the third issue is a direct water quality issue as well. And this deals with what we call contaminants of emerging concern. This phrase is used a lot in legislative language, so I'm hoping you already know something about this. But these are essentially unregulated contaminants. Hundreds of them occur in our environment, mostly in our aquatic environment. We know they're out there. We don't know the impacts on humans. We do know that they have impacts on wildlife and fish. That's well established both here in the state and elsewhere. But we have hundreds of contaminants that are not regulated because we essentially don't know quite enough about them to regulate them using our existing risk assessment approach. What do we want for the future? A society that has reduced risk from toxic contaminants. Our first strategy is to move to green chemistry. So the first strategy is to move upstream. Don't let these contaminants into the environment in the first place. Instead of putting them in the environment and then cleaning them out of it again, prevent them in the first place. So if you're familiar with the green chemistry movement, again, it's a fairly, at this point, it's discussed quite a bit. It's really to find ways to encourage industry to move to processes that use less toxic chemicals, and it's cost-effective for them in the long run because they generate less toxic waste for them to dispose of in the making of their products. And so it's to find ways for Minnesota to promote and encourage the green chemistry in our state manufacturing. The second is, what do we do about these hundreds of contaminants that we already know are in our environment? Some of them are probably not harmful. Some of them probably are. And how do we sort that out, and how do we deal with that? Frankly, in the past, we've done sort of crisis management. We have focused as a state or as a legislature on one issue at a time. One, you know, the chemical of the week gets the attention. And what we really need is a thoughtful, clear process for how we're going to deal with contaminants that are already here in the environment. There is an excellent process being used at your request by the Minnesota Department of Health that is looking at contaminants of emerging concern and looking at how to best manage them for drinking water exposure to humans. We are recommending that that process be fully expanded to include ecosystems and other sources of exposure, such as food exposure and air exposure. But we know that there is a process that can be used, and the Department of Health is, I think, leading that effort and doing an excellent job at it. So we really encourage that effort to be expanded. We know that this this body has also looked at pharmaceutical disposal. So these contaminants of concern largely exist around two classes of chemicals. One are these chemicals that can mimic hormones. We call them endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And then we also have chemicals that are pharmaceuticals or breakdown products of pharmaceuticals that result in the environment because of disposal and consumer use. And so we're also recommending that we develop a more comprehensive and robust policy around drug disposal. We certainly have made some efforts to make some progress in that area, but we have a ways to go, and we're strongly recommending that we make that a more robust policy for making sure we don't have drugs in our drinking water. The fourth issue is land and the connection between land and water. Now, obviously, everything we do on the land affects water. It all runs downhill, so any activity on the land ultimately impacts water quality and quantity. Our first recommendation is to integrate water and land planning. Currently, we do comprehensive land planning and we do water plans. They're only actually required they have different requirements in the metro versus the rest of the state, and we're really recommending one fairly obvious, I think, kind of no-brainer kind of recommendation. Water and land planning should be done together by the same people. It shouldn't be done separately. We have a water plan here and a land plan here. They're on different scales. They're with different people. When you're talking about the same population and the same land, it does not make sense. And so why not integrate these approaches and do this in an integrated way? Specific recommendations deal with incorporating water sustainability into our land use permitting processes, increasing compliance capacity at the local level. We heard repeatedly from counties and cities that they would love to take existing law and existing zoning and making sure it was enforced, but they don't have the capacity. So let's increase that capacity locally to make sure that we can meet current laws and rules. And then to monitor for the effectiveness of land practice. So we have best management for stormwater practice and for agricultural practice and for all sorts of land use practice. Let's evaluate those practices and figure out how effective they are so we can better manage in the future. The fifth issue is ecological and hydrologic integrity. It's very, very important to appreciate that healthy people require a healthy environment, and that our economy requires a healthy environment. When you think about our economy, it's based on agriculture, that's the environment, and it's based on tourism, and that's the environment. Without a healthy environment, we don't have a healthy economy, and we certainly don't have healthy people. So these things are all connected. Furthermore, the ecosystems depend on water flow, which is the hydrologic cycle. And so having hydrologic integrity is connected to ecological integrity. And so these systems, again, it's you have to take a systems approach to thinking about this. One cannot think about just one little piece of this. We recommend that we protect critical aquatic ecosystems. The first recommendation to achieve that strategy is to pass an Ecosystem Integrity Act, which would really be an umbrella to articulate many of the concepts that are found within these strategies within this issue. It would be to consider ecological benefits in environmental review, and we would also need to know about how to best implement climate adaptation strategies for the future. If we restore ecosystems to today's climate, we would be making a mistake. Our climate has already changed in the past 10, 20, 30 years, and it's going to continue to change, and we need to make sure that we're thinking about ecosystem restoration in 2030 and 2040 and 2050, which will be a different set of conditions. It will be warmer and it will be wetter in 20 and 30 years. The second major strategy in this issue is to prevent introductions and reduce the impacts of aquatic invasive species. Those of you that are familiar with the whole issue of invasive species know that once a species has gotten a foothold in the state, you can't get rid of it. You can't eradicate it. You can just manage it. And if you're just going to manage it, it's going to be super expensive. It's remarkably expensive. We spend probably billions in this state on invasive species management. Just think zebra mussels, think sea lamprey. We spend a lot of money on managing aquatic invasive species. So it's best to prevent them in the first place. We have policies around invasive species, and I want to say that the DNR does an excellent job at this, but they could do a better job if they had a broader mandate for really developing a statewide policy on prevention and management of invasive species. And we also need research on the effectiveness of these various controls. There's a lot of work already done on this, but not enough to actually manage many of our invasive species. The next strategy deals more with the hydrologic aspects of maintaining hydrologic integrity. So we've spent a lot of the last 100 and some years removing water from the land as quickly as possible so that we could make the land as productive as possible for agriculture. Now, agriculture is very important, and it was important to remove much of this water. But we probably have removed it too much water, and we've probably moved it too quickly. And we know that because of the impact on water quality, and that's one of the reasons that we are in violation of clean water standards. So we are recommending that we slow down that water off the land, the movement of the flow of water off the land, and then we keep a little bit more on the land and let it infiltrate. And so we're not saying let's go back to 1850, just to be very clear. We're saying let's just slow that water down a bit and make sure that some of it infiltrates so that we are protecting both our water quality and, frankly, protecting the soil quality in our agricultural fields. So the first recommendation is to accelerate the development of a hydrologic assessment model. This model has been developed by the Army Corps of Engineers, is being used and developed for the state by the DNR. It's a really, if you have ever seen this model demonstrated, imagine a 2-inch rainfall simulated on a watershed. You can see where that 2-inch, which is a flood level kind of rain, you can see where that 2-inch rainfall goes, so you can see where you would need to plan for flood control. This is a very sophisticated model, and we're recommending that it be expanded and accelerated in the development to be as widely used across the state as possible. It's an excellent way to predict where water will go in high precipitation events, and it will help for land planning and flood control planning. It also helps predict what happens on fields. So it would also predict not just what happens in cities in terms of flooding. It would predict drainage flow, et cetera, through agricultural fields, and so it would help with both predicting what happens in precipitation events around drainage as well as floods. We also are recommending that we develop a model that understands and can predict water flow at the field scale. What I mean there is at the farm level, at an individual farm level. This would be an incredibly valuable tool for an individual farmer to know what happens to their land during a high precipitation event or during any kind of a application of fertilizer or something like that. They could actually look at what happens as a result of their individual land practice on what happens to essentially the water outflow from their farm. This is something that could be done. It would require some investment, but being able to develop these models really just is a matter of resources and some time and effort to develop these kinds of models. The field scale models can be linked to broader models, to watershed scale models, so that pretty soon you will be able to have a picture of what happens under certain circumstances, under changes of climate, all the way to changes of precipitation or to land use practice. You can see the effect on water from what happens at an individual scale. Finally, we would recommend that any new construction of drainage tile or any replacement construction of drainage tile incorporate some aspect of drainage conservation technology. Preferably, they would use manage drainage in their reconstruction or replacement or their new construction. But we recognize that that's again, one size doesn't fit all, and the farmer knows what's best for managing what's going on their land. So we actually are recommending that they would be required to use some kind of conservation practice, but it would be from a list of many, many types of practices, everything from constructed wetlands to tile drainage changes. So we're really looking at, again, letting the individual farmer figure out how to meet a performance-based concept. And finally, to expand the program that already exists within Bowser to retrofit existing tile drainage systems. Right now, they provide a 75% match to farmers that wish to replace their tile drainage with managed drainage systems. The problem is there's only a little bit of money in that program, so only a handful of farmers are really getting the benefit of that. And if we want to deal with existing tile drainage and the impact on water quality, one really good way to do that would be to incentivize through this matching program to expand that program and make it more accessible to more agricultural folks. The last strategy has to do with maximizing our lands that are in set-aside conservation programs. So a lot of water quality is protected by our existing set-aside. So I'm talking here about the CRP program, the RIM program, et cetera. There are a number of different conservation set-aside programs. These programs are highly effective at protecting water quality. Hundreds of thousands of acres that are currently in protection are slated to expire over the next 10 years. And we want to make sure that that doesn't happen. We want to make sure those farmers continue to take that marginal land and put it in set aside. And so we're recommending that the state really pay attention to what ways they could invest in these various set aside programs to encourage not only the maintenance of the current amount of acres in placement and set-aside programs, but to actually expand it so that all marginal lands are in set-aside. Also to work on the next farm bill. The next farm bill is due to be dealt with in probably 2012, 2013. And in the past, Minnesota has worked very effectively to influence the outcome of that farm bill. We're recommending that we continue to work with the authors of the farm bill to maximize those conservation elements in the federal bill. Next issue is the water energy nexus. Now, this is not, unless you think about this, if you haven't thought about this, I'll just say it's not intuitive until you sort of really you realize how connected these are. So our wastewater treatment plants, that's a water issue, takes a ton of energy to clean water. It takes a ton of it. We have a huge amount of energy goes into cleaning our water. It takes water to grow corn for biomass stock for biofuels. And it also takes a lot of water to make electricity. So, in fact, the biggest use of water in the state, 67% of our water use, is cooling water for electricity plants. So water and energy are very interconnected. So if we change how we treat wastewater, it's going to impact energy. And so if we care about energy, which I know many of you do, we have to deal with those as an integrated system. Water and energy are integrated. We basically are recommending that we understand those relationships in a quantitative way. How many kilojoules does it take to clean a gallon of water? California has done this, and it's helping them manage both their energy problem and their water problem. And we're recommending that we get ahead of our own curve here and that we understand those relationships in a quantitative way so that we can then understand how to best manage both of those very important resources. The next issue is water pricing and valuation. Currently, the legislature has already passed a law that is requiring conservation pricing in 2013 across the state. By conservation pricing, it means that the price of additional water use goes up so that your last gallon of water costs more than your first gallon of water, and it's to improve conservation within the state. We are recommending that a small fee be added to the cost of water pricing to pay for ecological services and ecological benefits that have been taken away by having built a drinking water plant or by having built a wastewater treatment plant within that municipality. We're basically saying right now we don't pay for the true cost of water. Water costs more than we pay for it. And we're saying why don't we actually pay for the cost of water? It turns out that cost has been estimated, and it's about $5 a year per family. It's not a lot of money. And so if we just add that to the water bill, then instead of having that be an externalized kind of cost, an externality that is paid for by pollution problems or by other kinds of taxes or lost use of that resource, we're saying let's pay for it and keep the resource in good use. Public water infrastructure, and here we're dealing primarily with the infrastructure, public infrastructure around drinking water treatment plants and wastewater treatment plants. The first strategy is to make sure that we're not just building 1970s drinking water and wastewater treatment plants. We have new problems, and these wastewater treatment plants that come online need to have new technologies to remove new pollutants and not just remove phosphorus and nitrogen. These technologies are being developed. They're being developed literally daily. This is an area of research for me, and I will tell you that there's a new paper in the literature almost daily on the new technologies and their efficacy for treating new pollutants. So this is a moving target. It's not like we could make a recommendation. It'd be out of date in about 5 days. So the point here is that we create a standing committee to advise the MPCA and the Public Facilities Authority on what are the technologies that are coming down the pike, what are the technologies that are really the ones we should be focusing on. Because I'll tell you, it's a very much a moving target at the moment. Second strategy is to develop a plan for paying for this. Infrastructure is the single most expensive item in our portfolio of water issues. There is nothing more expensive than building more water treatment plants and drinking water plants. If you think about it, wastewater treatment plants were mostly built in the 70s in response to the Clean Water Act around the country. They have a lifetime of about 40 to 50 years. You can do the math. You can see that we're going to have to build a whole bunch of wastewater treatment plants all at once. It's an accelerating train wreck, and we're going to have to deal with this. It's not like we can just do it on a rolling way. We have to deal with this. It's going to be a big train wreck in 10 to 20 years. So we need to plan for this. And right now, the federal revolving funds do not cover these costs, and we need to come up with a strategy for how we're going to cover them. And if they can't be covered by the federal government alone. They can't be covered by the state matching program alone. They can't be covered by the Clean Water Fund alone. There's not enough funds. Everyone's going to have to have some pain around that issue. If we want drinking water and we want our sewage treated, we're all going to have to pay for it. And that's going to be a very complicated but important and necessary discussion to have. We're recommending that a strategy be developed for the future and implemented so that we pay as we go for these treatment plants, because they're all going to come at us pretty quickly here. The next couple of issues deal with social issues. We're recommending strategies and recommendations around making sure that we have public engagement programs, that we have educational programs, both formal education as well as citizen education. I'm going to move quickly through here. And then finally, we have recommendations around governance and institutions. We recognize that we have very strong water law in this state. We have very robust laws. They have mostly developed in response to an issue, so they tend to be fairly focused law. And what we're recommending is that these laws be reviewed in total for whether they are in alignment with this principle of water sustainability that is now in statute. So let's review these laws and let's make any changes that are necessary. This is not a trivial recommendation. We recognize that it would take quite a bit to review these laws, but we feel it's very important that our water law be reviewed, our land use law, our energy law, our transportation law be reviewed for water sustainability. There are instances of where some of our laws kind of are perpendicular to water law, and so we want to make sure that these laws are aligned and they're all working for the best for Minnesota water. We also recommending that the legislature reestablish the Legislative Water Commission. This body was disbanded in the 80s due to budget constraints. Water is a complex issue. As you see, we've just covered soup to nuts. It's an incredibly complex system. It requires people within the legislature to really devote some time and energy to understanding the complexity of these issues. And we feel that the Water Commission is the best way to do that. We also are recommending some governance changes. Now, there's lots of discussion about, well, should we form a water department? Should we take the PCA and put it in the DNR? Should we do this or that? And I'll just tell you right now, we didn't go there. There's no justification for rearranging the deck chairs. Not on the Titanic. We're not sinking. But we are not interested in rearranging the deck chairs. What we are interested in is two recommendations around efficiencies that we feel could be done and would make water management more efficient. The first is to establish a state water sustainability board. Or you think we're adding a layer of government, this is not that recommendation. This recommendation is to replace two existing boards. So this actually is an efficiency by streamlining two relatively inefficient processes and creating one much more efficient sustainability board. So we're recommending that the Clean Water Council would morph into the Water Sustainability Board and be disbanded, essentially. We create this new board, and that the water function of the EQB would also be disbanded and put into this new board. So we would make one board be responsible for water sustainability at the statewide level, and they would also provide oversight down to the watershed level. Right now, the watersheds kind of don't really have a place to report up to, and we would recommend that this sustainability board be that accountability level within state government. We also are recommending that currently at the watershed level, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cooks in the kitchen. We have watershed districts. We have watershed management organizations. We have soil and water conservation districts. We have all these things going on at the watershed level. And we are recommending that we basically evolve these organizations into a single organization at the watershed level. We give it a new name just to get rid of the baggage. So we're recommending we form watershed and soil conservation authorities at the watershed level. Finally, we recommend that this be a living document. It be reviewed every 5 years formally by someone outside of the legislature, an independent entity that could review this and update it and make recommendations for its future, so that this is a living document and not something that gets put on a shelf. Okay, gave you a lot of information in a really fast time frame. I'm going to give you my Letterman top 10, except I'm going to reduce it to 5. If you could only do a few things, which I know you can only do a few things at a time, based on the resources and timing. There are some aspects of this plan which are essential if we want water sustainability. And these are listed here. It's to protect water quality and quantity by revising the permitting process for appropriation, by modeling our water balance, by requiring pollutant reductions be mandatory, and that there be equity in those solutions by bringing agriculture to the table on how to get there, and that we address future contaminants. We have hundreds of them out there. Right now we're regulating a handful. So these are critical issues for reaching water sustainability. The other two issues that are critical for water sustainability have to do with the connection of water to land. And so the integration of water and land planning is essential, and to align our policies around water sustainability is also essential. So these are the top issues. We're recommending a phased implementation. Again, not all of these recommendations are as urgent as others. So we have four phases we're recommending. Some, because of either they're low-hanging fruit, they're easy to do, they don't cost much, and or they need to start now in order to see an outcome within 10 years, these things need to start now. And so we have a series of recommendations that are in what we call phase one. They should start now. They should be implemented now. Then we have recommendations that are pretty important and pretty urgent, and they should start in about 3 years. And we have another series of recommendations that can wait 5 years. They're not less important. They just aren't quite as urgent. And then finally, issues around water reuse. You know, that's not an urgent issue. It's an important issue, but not urgent. So we're recommending that could wait even 10 years. So in our executive summary, you will have the executive summary. You will see something we're calling a dashboard, and it summarizes every recommendation, gives you information on who should implement the recommendation, gives you a sense of the phase, of the timing, so it's identified as a phase one recommendation or a phase four recommendation. It gives you an indication of how important it is to water quality, and it gives you an idea as to whether the recommendation provides additional benefits to other natural resources and public health. And so then the ones in italics throughout the document are the ones that are the most essential. Those five essential things that I just talked about are in italics in this summary. So this just shows issue A. We have a dashboard that's actually for all 10 issues and all of the recommendations in a single table. With that, I will stop. Thank you for your patience. I just want to, again, really share with you how passionate I feel about this. We are in a rare moment of time. It's a historic point in time that we have here with so many of our citizens supporting clean water. We have the Clean Water Fund. We have all of you. Water is a nonpartisan issue. It's something we all want, clean water. I don't know anyone who's ever said, oh, I don't want clean water. This is an important issue, and we have a rare moment to actually deal with it. So thank you for your attention, and I'll take as many questions as Representative McNamara allows me to take.
Well, thank you, Dr. Schweighammer. We really appreciate you coming in right away. It was an important study, and it did use, I think, if I'm not mistaken, $750,000 of the new dedicated sales tax money from the Clean Water Fund. So thank you for the presentation. We do have time for just a couple of questions. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Schweighammer, we've discussed many of these issues over and over again. I'd like to go back to near the beginning of your report where you had a map that highlighted the water, groundwater use here in the metro area. It's quite dramatic that groundwater is being used very aggressively, and here in the metro, and as you went through your report, I really didn't hear much of what you're proposing that would address reducing this impact of groundwater usage here in the metro. Do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, we have, it's more implicit than perhaps I stated. If we understood our water balance, we would understand what withdrawals at this level would mean. So these estimates were done using fairly crude modeling. So I wouldn't bet a lot of money that these are highly accurate, all right? So the point would be is that we would be able to develop a much more comprehensive model. Oh, and also, this only deals with shallow aquifers. It doesn't deal with deep aquifers. So we would want to make sure that we understood the full water balance so that we could then regulate how much of these withdrawals took place and from where. Right now, they're just happening willy-nilly, so we're not controlling those withdrawals. We just know that they could have an impact by 2030.
Follow-up. So you really don't have anything in here that would address reducing water usage here in the metro?
Dr. Schweighammer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, if you had this water model, then you could make those decisions. It's almost impossible to make those kinds of decisions without, because you're making those decisions in the dark, essentially.
Thank you.
It's that bank account analogy. We don't know how to control spending if we don't know how much is there.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Schweighammer, I was looking closely through the presentation, but one of the words I didn't see was flooding. And you mentioned the interaction between groundwater and surface water, but if we have catastrophic flooding events, we can be dealing with a variety of contaminants as well as quantity and quality issues, both for the public infrastructure. I think in Rushford we had to replace the whole wastewater treatment system there. So could you maybe address how flooding fits in or what was involved in the discussion in preparing the report on how flooding is taken into account?
Dr. Schweighammer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we didn't come up with specific recommendations around flood control in terms of structures, but we do address flooding in the context of the hydrologic, managing hydrologic integrity. If we slow down water movement off the land, and we have ways to do that, ways to predict its movement and ways to slow it down, we will definitely help mitigate flooding. So one of the outcomes is reduced flooding as a result of these recommendations. You might not have, you know, we didn't explicitly say this will reduce flooding, but we do in the document. I didn't say it here. But it's the hydrologic integrity piece is where we would hope to mitigate flooding by slowing down the movement of water off the land and also being able to predict where it goes. We can do a lot better land planning. Both suburban, urban, and agricultural lands can be better managed if we understand that flow.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Schweighammer. So I understand about keeping water on the land, and I think we've talked about that for the last few years, but how about the cross-contamination question? You have a flood event, and you have a variety of all kinds of things get mixed together. We have everything that was mentioned individually becomes part of a huge problem, depending on the quantity of the flood event. So how do we, you know, we could do a lot of things trying to manage one contaminant that gets wiped out with a major flood. How did that contamination question get addressed in the study?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dr. Hansen, we I definitely appreciate what you're saying, and actually I want to thank you for appreciating the complexity of the issue, that you can't deal with these in isolation. The flooding issue is, I'd love to be able to prevent floods in the first place, but we can't. But we can make our systems more resilient to changes in hydrologic flow. So the idea is to build in resiliency, both in terms of our infrastructure for wastewater, as you mentioned, you know, the idea of not having that back up, or the mess you've seen in Australia, if you've been following that mess. We can't prevent those kinds of astonishing floods, but we can build in resilience. And so many of the recommendations deal with building in that kind of resilience. Understanding, I mean, knowledge of where the water goes is so critical to management. And if we understood that, we could change the way we build our cities, change the way maybe we build our wastewater treatment plants, or where they get sited. I mean, there is a whole bunch of issues that could be addressed if we understood where the water went. And we're remarkably ignorant of that today.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. And, well, Representative Quam asked this question. If the EQB could come down and get their overhead going, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair. Professor Schwackhammer, these are two quick, more or less yes-no. You've got your modeling and real-time sensor and data system. Are you looking at sort of a smart water system similar to the smart city systems coming out that are using clouds and a parallel processing?
Dr. Schweikamp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that certainly could be one of the applications of those kinds of sensors and new technologies. We didn't get that specific about how to do it.
And the other one is on the more detailed report.
Representative Quam.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the more detailed report, are you going over effects similar to, say, the marginal land side effect from the Green Acres Law and that effect of those types of legislation on runoff and contamination?
Dr. Schweikhammer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we did not get that detailed and look at that issue specifically.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Schweikhammer, for your presentation. You're going to email to us electronically the full report, and will it include your email on that? We did have a couple members that had additional questions, and so they'll be getting that electronically, and there'll be an opportunity to communicate back and forth.
Mr. Chair,
thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. We expect to have the completed document posted and sent to you electronically by next week. We're also printing copies. Many people would prefer the paper copy over the electronic one, and don't try to print this on your home computer, I'll say that. And we are happy to provide additional copies at your request. We also are happy to come back and speak to you individually or collectively at any time to explain these recommendations. Thank you very much.
Dr. Schreckhammer, if I may, I would appreciate it if you would not paper copy the members with the large copy. If they want that, they can print that in their own here or can look at it electronically, unless any one of them want to raise their hand right now to tell you they want a paper copy, and I got a feeling they're not going to do that. So we would appreciate it if you wouldn't. Do the members want a paper copy? Okay. Go ahead and send them then. Send it to all of us, a paper copy to the members of the committee, and then we'll forward it on to the rest of the legislature if they want that. Representative Deal.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and on behalf of the logging industry, I appreciate your
I thought you might make that comment, Representative Deal. Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from Representative Beard.
While we're transitioning to the next one, let me just make a comment that in the district I represent, we have the Midwaukett and Sioux community, which has a cutting-edge wastewater recycling facility, and they're actually doing some re-injection of treated water back into the aquifer that drifts back underneath the reservation. We may want to have them in and describe that to us. Or if you want to do a field trip, I'd be happy to treat you the trip to my district to see the place. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, thank you, Representative Beard. Do you have a bakery down there?
A couple of outstanding bakeries, Representative Mr.
All right,
Mr.
thank
Chairman.
You. Next, we're going to hear from the Environmental Quality Board, and Ms. Van Buren Hansen is going to do a presentation about their, I believe it's once a decade, Minnesota water plan. Welcome, Ms. Van Buren Hansen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Princesa Van Buren Hansen. I'm with the Environmental Quality Board staff. You're receiving a copy of the presentation this morning, as well as just a one-page summary overlying the report. I believe that Ms. Rudolph sent out an email yesterday with a web link. I do have some paper copies, recognizing that some may desire that, and some may be happy with the web, so both are available. After this is handed out, if anybody wants paper copies, I have a couple more coming. First off, I'd like to take just a little bit of time to talk with you about the Environmental Quality Board itself. This board was created back in 1973. It brings together the commissioners of 9 state agencies, along with 5 citizen members, and a representative of the governor's office. The board was created understanding that it's really important with some of these environmental issues that cut across agency boundaries that we have a forum in which the public and the various agency representatives can get together to discuss them, to discuss those things that cut across those agency interests, and to provide a forum in which we can coordinate plans, policy, programs, and various needs. It also exists to look at environmental review issues and to really engage the citizens of Minnesota. The 2010 water plan that I'll be talking about today really continues a conversation that we've been engaging in for a number of years. The Environmental Quality Board in 2007 worked with DNR, as was mentioned briefly earlier today, to look at water availability in Minnesota. What do we have? What do we need? What do we need to consider for future generations? And that conversation was continued in 2008 when the MPCA board asked the EQB to continue working with members to look at water allocations and how to put that in a larger context where we can look at them broadly as they impact each other. So looking today at our state water plan, the EQB is charged in 103B, 151, to look at water planning, programs, policy, and other interests on a 10-year basis. We have a rich history of doing this. This is the fourth plan we've done. We have plans that were generated in 1979, 1991, 2000, and again today. Looking back over those plans, looking at the evolution of challenges and opportunities over time, what we see is really what this calls for is we need to work together. Success as we deal with these environmental and water issues is about engaging stakeholders, local government, state government, the legislature, in a conversation about what our needs are and where we need to go. At the same time, the state recognizes that we're really responsible to future generations. As Deb mentioned earlier this morning, this is a unique time. We've had a lot of conversations recently. We've had the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act and then the amendment. There's been a lot of discussion in the media and by the public about our water needs and the value that it presents to Minnesota. So the goals of the report, first, to really define a vision for our future around water sustainability. We were lacking a really clear vision for all of us to be able to work toward. At the same time, it was to build a broad and adaptive framework. As you know, water is in a number of different agencies, and it's governed in many areas. And with that, it's broad. There's a number of individualized programs. So the state water plan, I actually think there's a certain kind of beauty in the breadth that it provides, is that it can be applied to each of those programs. It's robust in the fact that because it can be developed for each program individually, that it applies to each, it makes it easier to adapt over time and to continue to be used in the coming decade. Another goal was to really articulate the state strategies for how we're going to achieve sustainable water management. And lastly, recognizing that the state water planning process was going on concurrent to the University of Minnesota's framework. And so throughout the past couple of years, we've continued this dialogue. Everyone involved with the state water planning process was also involved with the use process. And so we've had a number of conversations and communications along the way. The report is broken into three main sections. The first, we reflect on the past. We look back to those three previous plans. What did they say? Where have we gone? What are some of the gaps and the opportunities? What are some of the strengths we've had? And what are those weaknesses we still need to work on? The second part, we talk about the status of our resources in the present. The appendix brings together monitoring and program update reports from the various agencies, telling us about our water quantity and our water quality and giving us a snapshot of the year 2010. And then the real foundation to the report is that third part, charting a roadmap for the future, looking what do we need to do in the coming 10 years as we look to our long-term future. That third section, charting the roadmap for the future, articulates the strategies. It tells us what do we as the state agencies need to be doing. It recognizes that we've been building a foundation. There's been a lot of ramping up of efforts in the last few years as supported through the legislature and the Clean Water Fund dollars and the Clean Water Legacy Act. And then also we look at seven implementation principles. These are overarching principles. They tell us how to put those strategies in place. And all of this conversation, water sustainability of quantity and quality for the future generations, is our goal. The strategies, there's nine strategies. The first couple are a little bit more proactive in nature. They look at some of the things that Representative Torkelson just mentioned, the fact that we need to protect the resources we have, both quantity and quality. We need to preserve through wise use and wise conservation. So what these first couple strategies look at is we have tools available to us today we haven't had in the past. We can better identify our high-value resources and our resources that are most vulnerable or at risk. And then we can put practices in place. If we're more proactive in this way, it's actually more cost-effective to try to prevent problems versus to try to restore them later. The second and third and fourth strategies talk about the fact that we recognize that this needs to be a partnership with our local interests and landowners, that we need to engage at the local level, the people who know the problems, who know the opportunities, who are putting practices in place. And so we need to really have a strong partnership at the local level. The other thing we need to do is we need to look at the proper management units. We recognize that some of the systems of the past have had limitations. Monitoring on a well-by-well basis or looking at a streamreach by streamreach for quality doesn't work. And so we're adapting to broader perspectives where we look at quality on a watershed area, where we look at quantity in groundwater management areas. And so it calls for looking at the proper management region for the areas that you're looking at assessing and then acting upon. The next strategies focus on the information we need. We have a lot of data available to us, but there's some areas where we still have gaps. There's things that we need to better understand. So it calls for us to prioritize what those needs are, what data do we need to collect, and then it challenges us to consider where that data is going to be used and by whom. We need to make sure that we're in concurrence, we're working in a very coordinated manner in how we collect data, that it's in the proper sort of context so it can be used by others, but we also need to consider that there's a number of users of that data. We need to make it available to the public, to counties, to local government for their decision-making purposes. We also recognize that there's a number of tools. When we're looking at land and water management in combination, there's a whole series of things that are available to us. There's rules, there's regulation, there's incentives, there's education, and we need to make sure that we have up-to-date tools and that they're being used in the proper combination. Oftentimes you don't use a single tool alone, but rather use a suite of tools to achieve the outcome that you desire. We also need to really apply a targeted approach for protection and restoration. I mentioned we have tools available to us today we haven't in the past. And so we need to make sure that we're targeting and prioritizing where we're going to be putting those efforts on the ground and trying to impact our waters. And our last strategy recognizes that there are emerging threats before us. Whether we're looking at contaminants of emerging concern, aquatic invasive species, or climate change, we need a systematic way to address these issues. And so it calls for the agencies to work together to develop that systematic approach for things that we might be talking about in the 2020 water plan that we aren't today. And then we have our seven implementation principles. These are overarching and broad, and really this is a way of doing business. They apply to how state agencies manage their various programs. It recognizes that we need to continue to optimize our coordination. There's some areas where we're well coordinated and there's other areas where we really need to work on that. But it's not even just within the state agencies. It calls for us to coordinate with local government stakeholders, federal government, and others who are involved in all of these management areas. We need to look at land and water management holistically, understanding that they're very interconnected. Deb spoke about that earlier today as well. And then as we make decisions today, we're going to continue to learn more information in the coming years. So we need to make sure that we're adaptively managing our programs, that we're incorporating the new information, and that we're doing a better job each year, looking back at where we've been. We need goals and measures to say where we are today and make sure that we're making progress to the outcomes that we seek. We need to continue to educate and engage people about the programs that we do, the activities that we have in place, and their role in contributing to that so that we can have a partnership of working together. And in all things, we need to have this shared long-term vision. We need to be able to communicate on the same page together. Some of the strengths of the plan are that it unifies state water activities. You know, again, there are a number of water reports from various agencies, but the uniqueness of this is that we all came to the table together, and we approach this in a very coordinated and unified way. It approaches all the various programs from a common perspective and then communicates that to the public. So instead of appearing to be a series of, you know, kind of disparate agency programs, it is brought together. It also documents state agency consensus and our commitment in the coming decade to continue to grow upon the foundation that we've laid in recent years, to continue the improvements and progress that we've been doing. And again, I really feel that this document, it does articulate a dynamic process. This is something that we're committed to incorporating, kind of like an operating plan in our programs, and continue to work with and revisit on a regular annual basis. And it provides also a foundation. As we're given direction through Clean Water Fund priorities, as we consider recommendations in the university framework, or recommendations from other areas, it gives us a framework in which to incorporate that into our programs. Again, it kind of as an operating plan is what it serves to the strategies and the principles. It allows us to take directions we're given, funding priorities that we receive, and make sure that we're being as efficient as possible with that. So some of the next steps, again, using this as an operational plan, is to continue to apply this within our state agency activities, to use it to implement upcoming Clean Water Fund priorities. We have 20-some years left of this dedicated funding to look at water and land management. We need to make sure that we're doing that effectively and continue to make sure it's grounded in providing success toward our desired outcomes. It's important, I think, now as the use framework comes out, that we have a very strong state dialogue about what that means. And so it provides a context in which to consider those things. And lastly, this document allows us to set goals and targets. We need to measure progress. Are we making trends in the right direction for what we want to do? And then we need to adapt based on that information. So I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about the direction provided in this 10-year document, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Van Buren Hansen. We're going to spend a few minutes asking questions, and hopefully there was a few other members that had questions for Dr. Schwackhammer, so we may get a chance to bring her back. Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for Ms. Van Buren Hansen or Dr. Schwackhammer. At the end, you talked about having... It's 23 years now, or 20, I'm not quite sure. More than 2 decades worth of this Clean Water Fund funding, dedicated funding, and I think that's a really exciting opportunity. And I'm a little nervous looking at both of these things about how we set the priorities. We've had a lot of process, and I think process is really important, but I'm not sure what recommended priorities are, where we should be spending the money to get certain outcomes, and I want to make sure in two more decades that Minnesotans, I would say a great outcome of this investment we're making in our state's future is that every Minnesotan can say, I know that my groundwater's okay, I know that the river I care about most is cleaner, and I know that we're building our cities in a way that have protecting this resource for the future. And I'm not sure, having heard this, where we spend the money to get outcomes we really care about. The legislature enacts laws, and we do a lot of these things we're looking at the end of the first plan we heard about, but I'm not sure about the investments and the right places to be spending the money looking at this. And I think that's something we'll be continuing to talk about, but I'm just sort of curious if either of you have some thoughts on that, or if some of that information will be more forthcoming in the broader plan, or the more specific plan.
Ms. Van Buren Hansen.
All right, Mr. Chair and Representative News. There are a whole series of priorities depending on the area granted. So as we look, say, to the state water plan, what we talk about is we know a lot more than we have in the past about how to prioritize where we need data to be collected to answer questions. We have processes that are better in place now to look at water quantity and water quality at larger scales. We need to really do a good job of managing that. And we also recognize that we need to prioritize engagement with stakeholders and local interests. So I think that we're starting in that right direction. You know, the PCA, for instance, looking at the intensive watershed management approach, where they've already mapped out for a number of years here when they'll be in the various watersheds. And so as we're doing that, we can prioritize the data within those watersheds we need to get at the TMDLs. And we can prioritize the stakeholder and other engagement to help us with putting practices in place with implementation and making that progress. We know better which areas of the state we have groundwater quantity or, you know, considerations and issues, so that we can prioritize focusing on those areas, either at higher risk or already experiencing conflicts with water quantity. And so I think that we need to continue the dialogue. It's a little bit of a regional approach of where we need to prioritize for various interests across the state.
Did you have comments, Dr. Schweighammer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, the prioritization that we've provided for you is really to say what are the most essential things that would need to get done. They're not, I don't think there's any mystery in any of that, of those priorities. What each one of them, I think, represent, though, are very tough issues to tackle. They can't be tackled in a biennium. They can get started in a biennium. But one of the reasons that it's so hard to know how to prioritize is that the really big issues that need to be addressed, knowing our water balance, dealing with meeting water quality standards, and dealing with new contaminants, those are the top three problems. And how do we address those? Our recommendations is to address those three things first. All of them are long-term investments, and so they really take a little, they take some effort to kind of get your hand around, because they are, you know, 5 to 10 year investments before we'd actually see that difference. One of the great things about the Clean Water Fund and the constitutional amendment is that it was meant to be long term. We have 25 years. We don't want to squander that. We don't want to take it for granted, but it allows us to actually address issues that we've never been able to address before. So they're not new issues. They're long time old issues, but this allows us to address them. So I think in terms of priorities, we've given you what we think are the most important issues and the most urgent issues to address, and they're not always the same. And when you see the final document, you will get this dashboard that really lays that all out for you in a lot more detail. But that one slide that has the top five, is that really does summarize a lot.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, you had a question earlier, and Dr. Schweighammer's back now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hansen and Dr. Schweighammer. I guess this will be maybe a question for Dr. Schweighammer, but either. We have heard that agriculture is one of the culprits, and we hear this over again, and we talk about and hear about some of the pollutants out there. We know that the EPA has conducted these benchmark studies that actually show we're seeing improvements in water quality around nitrates, coliform, and BOD. So I wonder if, two-part question, one is whether or not those have been acknowledged, and it's been acknowledged that actually in many ways our water quality is improving. And the other question deals with background levels on some of these. And Dr. Schweighammer's nodding her head, and I've asked many scientists this. So really the premise of really where you begin with TMDLs and the rest of the discussion needs to focus on what is the foundation upon which we start. Do we know what levels of nutrients, other elements, etc., are in these waters? Do we know what was there 200 years ago? And, or is our goal to have distilled water?
Dr. Schweighammer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, your name is almost as difficult as mine. Let me answer both of those. In terms of trend data, we know a fair amount about the trends in the state in terms of water quality, and many of the parameters that we track in the state are showing improvement. Where we don't show improvement and where we have a very bad track record is in nitrates. Nitrates both in drinking water wells and nitrate in general is not improving in the state. The other water quality parameters are, for the most part, sort of showing very little change at all over the last 10 or 15 years. And so that's one of the problems. We sort of did the low-hanging fruit back in the 70s and early 80s, and then we saw improvements. But it's kind of leveled off at that point. The other thing is we have national data, and the most recent report that came out from the United States Geological Survey, they conduct the National Assessment Program, the NAQUA program for the USGS, and they are the only nationally based monitoring program. And the USGS has just reported that phosphorus and nitrogen are both pretty much stable, except near agricultural areas we are seeing that nitrates are getting worse with time. And in near urban and agriculture areas we're seeing some declines in phosphorus. So we have both national data as well as state data to indicate that we're not seeing significant improvement that we can really point to. And in the case of nitrates, we're actually seeing some degradation. So that's the trend issue, in both from the state perspective and the national perspective. In terms of these background issues, I couldn't agree more that we can't treat every lake as if it started with, that it was, pristine, meaning it had no phosphorus or it had very low levels of phosphorus. We have lots of natural systems in the state that certainly 200 years ago were had excess nutrients, but not caused by human activity. They just were excess because they're shallow or they have a big surface area or whatever. But they have reasons to be already eutrophied.
Thank you, Dr. Schweikhammer. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to Ms. Van Buren Hansen. Structural, just a little backgrounding first on EQB. What branch of government does EQB exist under, and what kind of staffing levels do you have?
Ms. Van Buren Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, the Environmental Quality Board exists in the Department of Administration, part of the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning. It was put in the Department of Administration because it didn't have the affiliation with it wasn't one of the other environmental agencies, but existed in the planning function. Our staffing is quite small at the moment. We're in the neighborhood of 5 staff.
Thank follow you. Up, Representative Torkelson.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again to Ms. Van Buren Hansen, we noticed, one of the recommendations in the report from the university was that the Clean Water Council and EQB be combined. I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
Ms. Van Buren Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, it seems to me that what I've heard outlined from the university's recommendation speaks to something that is very much the functions that the EQB was created to do.
Thank you both. We have one more question from Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for Dr. Schweikhammer. I found interesting on the slide, unfortunately we don't have it up at the moment, but the water energy nexus, and I think the comment you made was that 67% of our water use is in energy. Could you detail that a little bit for me? What sources of energy, how that water is being used, how that impacts other things? Because when I hear that 2/3 of the water is used in one source, I mean, the first reaction is that seems like that's a large number, but could you please give some context to it?
Dr. Schweikhammer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, I'd be happy to do that. The 67% of our water is used for once through cooling for thermoelectric electricity generation. So these are essentially power plants. And it's once through cooling, it's taken from a source, it's put back in that source a little bit warmer. It's considered non-consumptive use because it has not been consumed. The same volume of water minus some evaporation goes right back to where it started. So it's considered non-consumptive. So most of our consumptive use is the other 30% of water in the state. So you could say, well, we're not consuming that water. It's not a big deal. The difference is that we're moving away from once through cooling. We're moving towards multiple pass-throughs for cooling. It's more efficient, but it becomes a consumptive use. And so we will have to deal with that change in how we use water in the future, and it's very much related to how we use energy.
Dr. Schweikhammer, I'd like to follow up on Representative Falk's question so I understand. When we toured the nuclear plant down at Prey Island, there was really big, huge pipes with water going through them that were used to cool the reactors. So that's the large volume of water that you're talking about that actually came out of the Mississippi and went back in, and you're counting that as a use in those numbers, or it was in the study.
Mr. Chair, yes, the way the DNR counts water and the way the USGS counts water nationally is they count cooling water as a use, but they do differentiate that it's non-consumptive because it comes out and goes right back. It is a little warmer. I believe that water would be non-consumptive.
Thank you, Dr. Schweikhammer. Representative Anderson, did you have a follow-up to Representative Falk's question? Go ahead. We'll do it real quick.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Representative Torkelson's question, it seemed to me a lot of the points raised and recommendations made in both of these reports were very similar. And is there, in this age of not duplicating things, are we both doing things the same, or is there a need for both reports, both groups? Could you both comment quickly on that?
Dr. Schweikhammer first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the university was asked to develop an independent report. The EQB does report and is part of the executive branch and so has some constraints as a result. We were also asked to develop a more detailed report. I think you see a difference in the level of detail in the two reports. They're very aligned. They're very consistent. I think we take those same ideas and take them down to the level of recommendation that is more detailed.
Thank you, Dr. Schweikhammer. Ms. Van Buren Hansen.
Representative Anderson. The Environmental Quality Board is charged to do this report on a 10-year basis. And so we take that, you know, very much to heart. And this is our really charting our conversation for the coming 10 years. What are we doing well? Where can we improve? And I think that along the way, the fact that we've had a good dialogue has helped to really make sure that we're doing this efficiently. I think where we find commonalities, it speaks to saying that we're on the right track.
Thank you both for your testimony today. We appreciate that. Members, in regards to upcoming meeting, I'd just like to make an announcement into the members of the audience. We're going to hear a bill Tuesday morning that will deal with nuclear power. We just talked about it a little bit. It'll be a rather short bill in the text of the bill that will deal with lifting what's commonly called the nuclear moratorium. I anticipate significant interest in it. And so that'll be heard Tuesday. I talked with Representative Hilty, and we will allow time on Monday for them to get amendments to us based on when he sees the actual language of the bill. Any questions by any members at this time? Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. I know when we heard this issue in Representative Hilty's committee was a couple years ago, we had several hours of testimony on both sides, and I'm wondering, just so the public knows and we're aware of how much input we're going to get on this, I think there'll be a lot of interest. I'm curious if you have a time frame or what that is and how we'll ensure the public's engaged.
We will have, we'll hear from both sides. Our meetings start at 8:15, they end at 10 o'clock. It's our intention to do it in that meeting time. Representative Hilty and I talked that we're going to reserve the room for that afternoon. The following day is our bipartisan gathering at the Humphrey Institute. So rather than carry on beyond that, we'll, if we have a number of questions from members or the amendments take longer, we'll come back Tuesday evening. But it's our intention to split the time between advocates and those opposed to the issue, equal amount of time. And we will ask them to keep on track. Mr. Harris, my CLA, is going to go out and purchase a timekeeper. We don't know if it's going to be the old-fashioned egg timer or if it'll be a modern digital-looking one, but we will keep people on track. You make a good point, Representative Knute, that the issue has been discussed a lot. We need to have more discussion, but I would recommend to both sides, make sure you bring your best people forward of who you want to testify. We'll treat them both equally. We'll have good discussion. It's an issue, I think, it's a long ways away. I don't think anybody's proposing. It's clear the power companies have not come forward. And they're not thinking about it today. They're not thinking about it next year. This is something far out, but it's consistent with the message that we heard last fall. This is about jobs and moving the economy forward, so we're going to have a good discussion in that regard. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.